is internet webcast bioavailability of metals, the first of the bioavailability, metals, organics, and youth at hazardous waste sites risk e-learning seminar series sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Basic Research Program. I am Justin Crane with the Superfund Basic Research Program, and I will be the technical moderator for today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot links on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have questions and answer sessions, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask questions. We ask that the phone line participants hold their questions until the question and answer session. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit star six to place your phone on mute. When you get to the question and answer period, you can hit star six to unmute the phone. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute. Do not put us on hold. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on slide one. All those participating via the internet should have clicked on the Go To session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on slide one of the presentation. The main page contains the slides, above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide, and need not wait until the question answer period to submit your question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot your problem. The presenters will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we will have question and answer sessions. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page, where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit star 6 now, and again, do not put us on hold. I will now turn the time over to Claudia Thompson, the Acting Director of the Superfund Basic Research Program. Claudia?
Thanks, Justin. First, I'd like to welcome all of you that are participating in our Risky Learning web-based seminar series that's sponsored by the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Basic Research Program in collaboration with the U.S. EPA. As you are aware, since this has been highly subscribed, today's session on bioavailability of metals is the first of a three-part series in the Bioavailability, Metals, Organics, and Use of Hazardous Waste Sites Risky Learning Web Seminar Series. Today's presenters will be Dr. Dominic DeToro and Dr. Nicholas Basta. Before we get started with the session, I just want to put a plug in for the next two sessions that we will be hosting. The second session will be Bioavailability of Organic Compounds, Methods, and Case Studies. That will air on June 11th. And will feature Edward Neuhauser and Danny Reibel. And then a week later, on June 18th, we'll conclude the series with a session on the use of bioavailability information at hazardous waste sites. The speakers for that will be Mike Berenger and Mark Mataloni. This has been a very active group who've been assigned to this, so I'm just plugging that if you're interested in these topics, to register early. Both sessions are open for registration. Before we get started, I'd like to do a couple of things. First, to Dr. Fred Fender, who's with the Superfund Basic Research Program at the University of North Carolina, who has really helped in some of the planning for this web series. He's had a long research interest in bioavailability and organized a seminar workshop recently in Florida on bioavailability. So at this time, I'd like to introduce and turn over the session to our moderator, Dr. Aaron Yao, an environmental health scientist in the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation at US EPA headquarters. Aaron's had a long history in interest in bioavailability, and he is currently the co-chair of the Bioavailability Committee, which is part of EPA's Technical Review Workgroup for Metals and Asbestos. This bioavailability committee plays an important role in developing bioavailability guidances, providing site consultation for hazardous and unhazardous waste sites, and identifying research needs and data gaps related to bioavailability. So at this time, welcome, Aaron, and I'm turning it over to you.
Thank you, Claudia, and I just wanted to welcome everyone for joining us today. As you know, EPA has put out two guidances last July on the use of bioavailability of metal data in soils. And we provide that in the related links, and hope everyone can refer to that in the future. But basically, bioavailability plays a huge important role in assessing human health risk from soils, particularly for two of our most common contaminants, lead and arsenic. Now, we also put out a technical support document for lead where we looked at two different methodologies, an in vivo swine methodology, as well as a lab in vitro methodology, and both of those correlated quite well. And in our guidance, basically, we laid forth different criteria that US EPA has adopted so that you can look at the validation of different in vitro methodologies. Traditionally, we've been using in vivo methodologies with juvenile swine, but those have proven to be lengthy and quite expensive. So we've laid out several different criteria that you can assess whether an in vitro methodology, that EPA will use to assess whether an in vitro methodology is correlated with an in vivo methodology. So small adjustments in bioavailability can make huge impacts on our cleanup numbers as well as our risk assessments. So today's presentations by Dr. Dominic DeToro as well as Dr. Nick Basta will play an important role in how we assess different research needs in the future. The first half of today's seminar will be presented by Dr. Dominic DeToro, who is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering with the University of Delaware, and he's also a member of the National Academy of Engineers. Dr. DeToro has specialized in the development and application of mathematical and statistical models to stream, lake, estuarine, and coastal water and sediment quality problems. The title of his talk is Environmental Control of Metal Bioavailability. Welcome, Dr. DeToro.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be to be presenting this webinar. I hope to see all of you out there smiling and nodding as I make the presentations. It's a little unusual not to have faces in front of me, but I think this is going to work very well, and I hope you all enjoy it. Please feel free to ask questions during the question period. The purpose of these seminars is to convey information, and if you'd like to, ask questions, please do so. I'm turning now to page 2, which is a collection of data that is designed to show you that bioavailability is not a factor of two kind of issue, but it is an order of magnitude kind of issue. And as such, it's quite important that it be dealt with properly if you're really going to have any hope of understanding what the interactions are between metals and various biota. Most of the examples I'll be showing you are from aquatic and sediment type data investigations. And the reason for that is that this problem, I think, was first taken seriously in the aquatic realm more or less for historical reasons, and also I think because in some ways it's simpler to deal with aquatic systems than it is to deal with systems that are more heterogeneous like sediments and soils. So what's plotted on figure 2 is a series of toxicity data. This is a single compound, copper, and it is a single organism, the fathead minnow. And what's plotted on this, every one of those little circles is a reported LC50 for dissolved copper when it's exposed to fathead minnows. And you can see that there are a number of two experiments that reported slightly greater than one part per billion, one microgram per liter. Some more that started to report numbers around 10 and 20. The majority are around 100 to 200. We have a significant number out at 1,000, even a few out at 4 or 5,000. So the LC50 for copper when exposed to fathead minnows is some number between 2 and 5,000. One can imagine that this makes life difficult if you're in the business of trying to regulate the copper concentration in receiving waters, making sensible risk assessments, and so on. So I think it's pretty clear that until you have a handle on what's going on with this kind of a situation, you're going to have a very difficult time making sense out of the responses that you see in the environment. And as the title says, there's essentially no correlation between total copper concentrations, which is the X, total dissolved copper concentration, which is the X-axis, and the frequency of biological results, that you can get any number between that varies almost more than three orders of magnitude. So clearly we have to do something about solving this problem. Now, I should point out, by the way, that a lot of this data comes from the original EPA criteria document for copper, 1984. EPA criteria, by the way, the water quality criteria, are really one of the most intellectually important and satisfying developments that the regulatory agency has made. They are the envy of the world and are used by pretty much everyone, the methodology that's taken to develop them. And in 1984, they knew about this problem. If you read the first couple of pages of the criteria document, it's almost agonizingly clear about the fact that they know about these variations, they have a pretty good idea what's causing them, but they had no tools. They simply couldn't do anything about it, and as a consequence, the criteria were set out in total copper concentrations. So, what's going on? What was the breakthrough that enabled us to understand what's happening? On slide number 3, there is a presentation of the data that was published by Bill Sunda as part of his PhD thesis in 1976. You can see that this problem has a long history. This is 1976. And there's a very nice review, by the way, by Peter Campbell. The references on most of these slides are at the bottom, so you can find them. What's plotted on the top figure is the concentration on the x-axis of total copper. And the units are molar concentrations minus log to the base 10 of total copper concentrations. And what's plotted on the y-axis is the specific growth rate of algae, a specific algae. I think it was, I'm not sure what it was, Solenestrum, I think. In any case, what you see is, and you should understand, by the way, that the x-axis is a backwards kind of axis. This is what chemists do in order to confuse the rest of us. They tend to use things that go backwards, so minus log to the base 10, that means a big number on the right-hand side, 7.4, is 10 to the minus 7.4 moles, molar concentration, so that's small. And as you go to the left, the concentration gets large. And you can see that what happens at very low copper concentrations, the growth rate is high, about 2 divisions per day. And as you increase the copper concentration going from right to left, the growth rate starts to drop until essentially you can get the concentration high enough, at least for certain cases, where you don't get any growth at all. Each of those symbols represent different chemical manipulations that Bill Sunda used in these experiments. So, for example, the pH is varying a little between 8.1 and 8.7. But the most important variation was the introduction of a complexing agent, TRIS, which can complex copper quite strongly. And you can see I've circled two data points, one in red, where the total copper concentration was 10 to the minus 4 molar, and the growth rate was essentially at control level. And another, the green circle, where again the total copper concentration was 10 to the minus 4, and the growth rates are suppressed quite a lot. What Bill Sunda did was, instead of plotting the growth rate versus the total copper concentration, he computed what the free ion activity must have been, which is the concentration of the divalent cation. And since Tris is a known ligand and his system is seawater, in fact, I think this is marine algae, he knew how to compute what the activity was of the divalent copper ion, and if he plotted that against, excuse me a second, yes? Yeah. Oh, my number, okay. I just got a call from the moderator telling me that my slide number is one behind everyone else's, so you ought to be all looking at slide 4. In any case, so now that you've seen, now that you're looking at slide 4, if you haven't figured it out, what's plotted on the bottom panel is the same data, but now plotted against the concentration, or actually the activity, but for all practical purposes in these kinds of problems, activity is concentration, close enough. And you see that remarkably all the data points line up. The red dot is the circle is showing predicting high growth rate, and the green circle dot is predicting low growth rate. Everything collapses onto one graph, and one might conclude from this that it is the divalent copper ion, the copper 2 plus ion, that is the toxic species. And that's often said in the literature. The only thing you can actually conclude from this is that the copper activity and the biological response correlate with each other. Whether or not it's really cause and effect, we'll continue talking about that as we go on. But this was the first great breakthrough. This is called the free ion activity model, and basically it posits the idea that if you can correlate the toxic effects that you're seeing to the activity of the divalent cation, and that solves a very large part of the problems that you're going to encounter. So that's important. But it turns out that it's not the whole story, as you'll see on slide 5. Slide 5 is, again, copper. The organism is now the cutthroat trout. Again, an old data set, 1979. Rene Russo, who for years was the lab director at the EPA Athens laboratory. This is some work that she did with her colleagues. And what's plotted here again is the LC50 and micromoles per liter on the y-axis, and then various manipulations of the chemistry on the x-axis. So let me discuss the green bars first. The LC50, when the alkalinity of the solution is low, and the alkalinity in this experiment is essentially proportional to the bicarbonate concentration, when the concentration of bicarbonate is low, the LC50 is perhaps 1.5 micromoles per liter. As you add alkalinity to the system following the red arrows, what happens is the LC50 goes up, so it takes more copper to have the same effect on the organism. And what's happening is that copper is complexing with the bicarbonate ion, forming copper bicarbonate complex, which is not bioavailable under the idea that the free ion activity of copper is the only thing that matters. So that we can understand very easily. The green bars are no problem. But look what happens as you change the hardness. Now, the hardness cations are calcium and magnesium. So as you decrease the concentration of calcium and magnesium, going from the green bars to the red bars, remarkably what happens is the LC50 goes down. That is to say, copper suddenly becomes more toxic as you reduce the hardness cations. Now, this is very hard to understand from the point of view of free ion activity models, because the calcium and magnesium are also divalent cations. They do not complex with the positive divalent cations of copper. So the interaction is not a chemical interaction. The free ion activity is the same, whether the hardness is low or high. So this kind of effect is not understandable in terms of the free ion activity model. Something else has to be added. And that's on slide 6. Slide 6 is a composite of a series of ideas that had been proposed by various workers in the early 80s through the early 90s. And the key idea that looked at the effect of the hardness cations is in the upper right hand. The reference is Pagenkopf, 1983, Environmental Science and Technology. And his idea was that not only is the side of action affected by the divalent cation, so in the center is the concentration of, let's say, divalent copper, for example. I mean, it doesn't have to be divalent, by the way. This works for, you know, silver monovalent ions as well. But in any case, so the free copper, if you like, free metal ion, interacts with the biotic ligand. The biotic ligand is our terminology for wherever the site of action is. For fish, it's well known that for the metals that, for which this is true, the big five, they interact with the gill surfaces and foul up the ionoregulatory system of the organism of fish. For other organisms, it was less clear. But the idea was that it had to work like this. There must be a receptor, and it must, if you believe the free ion activity model, it must be interacting with the free ion. So that's what that little arrow is. But what's happening as you increase calcium or sodium or protons is that they can also bind to this site of action. And so as you increase calcium, calcium binds to the sites on the gills, and that binding is not toxic. It does not foul up the operation of that enzyme, the transporters, whereas the metal cation, the divalent toxic cation, does. So the biotic ligand model explains the protective effect of the hardness cations as a competitive binding effect to the biotic ligand. Now, notice that this picture is very much a chemist's view of biology. I mean, what you see here are metal cations and anions that interact, and that they interact at a site of action. Not very much information about what's really going on at the site of action, simply binding constants that determine how strongly the binding is. So it's a very chemocentric view of biology, and I think modern advances, as we get better at this, we'll have to do a better job on the describing what's really going on in some more detail. But in any case, so now we have a mechanism, Pagenkopf proposed the mechanism, and in fact, Rick Plale and company made measurements in the early 90s where they actually demonstrated that the concentration of copper on the fish gills could be correlated to toxic effects, so we were getting at mechanism. But what prevented the use of this wonderful idea to implementation was the problem that in natural systems, metals not only complex with inorganic ligands, so the ones on the bottom, the OH and the bicarbonate and chloride and so on, but they also complex with organic matter in natural waters. And organic matter in natural waters is a complicated kind of a problem. And in order to be quantitative about this, one needs to be able to compute what is the free metal ion, what is the free ion activity, what is the concentration of copper 2 plus. And in order to do that, you need a model that can make calculations about how metals complex with organic matter. And Ed Tipping, over the years, actually starting in the aluminum and the acid rain days, has developed a model called WAM, the Windermere-Humic Aqueous Model, which has been available for now 20 years, roughly, and has been extensively calibrated to a large number of data sets. And with the advent of that model and its availability, it became possible to think about putting the whole thing together. And our contribution to this was simply putting it all together. The pieces had been around for quite a while. The trick was to actually do some calculations and convince yourself that you could do this. And so on the next slide, which is slide 7, you see a comparison of computed LC50s for Daphnium Magna using the biotic ligand model. On each of the panels on the y-axis is the predicted LC50 in micrograms per liter. On the x-axis is the observed concentration, again in micrograms per liter, for the five metals. The various symbols are different experimental data sets, and the reference there, you can find the details of this. The dotted lines are factors of two. plus and minus, well, times and divided by, these are log scales. And that is sort of our informal measure of how, if we can do it within a factor of two, we're happy and we leave better precision to the next generation. Certainly this is much better than the two or three orders of magnitude. By the way, take a look at the copper data, for example. You notice that the observed LC50s go anywhere from a little more than 10 to the 0 all the way out to 10 to the 3. So there's, again, the three orders of magnitude variation. Same organism, same metal. Only now we can understand all but about a factor of 2 with a couple of errant points. Of the variation. So the biotic ligand model has been enormously successful in not only in explaining things, but also pointing out where we don't understand what's going on. One of the most powerful uses of models is to analyze a data set, and if it doesn't fit, that's telling you that you don't know what's going on. Whereas just looking at the raw data, it's very hard to decide whether or not we understand what's happening or not. So, for example, that little upside-down triangle in the copper plot and some of the deviations in the lead data are telling us there's something going on that we don't understand. And so that points to the need for more work. One final comment about the biotic ligand model. The U.S. EPA draft freshwater copper criteria for the protection of aquatic life uses the biotic ligand model in the center of the criteria. So the criteria are computed using this calculation. You input the pH and the organic matter concentration, the hardness cations, and so on, and out comes the criteria for that particular water chemistry. So we've come a long way from simply specifying a total concentration of 1 or 2 parts per billion and assuming that that number is the correct number everywhere. So that's the story on where aquatic toxicology is. I'd like to show you the equivalent information for sediment toxicity. On slide 8 is a presentation of some data which has been assembled in order to derive the Canadian sediment criteria for copper. It's analogous, not quite analogous, but it's the same sort of presentation of a series of data. On the bottom, on the x-axis, is the sediment copper concentration, total concentration, so again, total, not divalent cation or anything, just the total concentration in experiments. And there are two kinds of symbols. One is the open symbols, which are experiments where no effect was observed. So at that concentration, for that particular experiment, there was no effect relative to controls. And the filled circles are where, in fact, effects were seen. Well, you can see that at low copper concentrations, 5, 10, 15, 20 parts per million, milligrams per kilogram, most of the data shows no effects. As you exceed what's called the threshold, the toxic effect threshold, so the TEL, you start seeing the incidence of effects. The black circles now are showing up, as well as you can see also open circles, so there's no guarantee that as you exceed the 35.7, you're going to see toxic effects. What the data tell you is that sometimes you see them. As you go out further and further, you notice that the probability of toxicity increases. There are about as many dark circles as there are open circles, and so the PEL, or the probable effect level, 197, those are the two criteria that are used in the Canadian criteria. Now, I mean, it sounds sensible, you know, if you can't do anything else, a statistical analysis of this sort is not completely crazy, but consider the following thing. Copper concentrations at 10 to 20 to even 30 parts per million are in the background. A soil or a sediment taken from an utterly unimpacted sediment will have concentrations of that order of magnitude, because that's the concentration in the background, soils in the shale background. So if you get rid of all those little circles that are below 10 or 20, notice that there's hardly any relationship between toxicity and total copper. There's almost as many open circles as there are dark circles, and certainly as you get to higher concentrations, that's true. So if I flip a coin, I have about as much chance of predicting whether or not a sediment is going to be toxic as I do knowing what the total copper concentration is in the sediment. I mean, it's dramatic. If the copper concentration is low, it's unlikely you're going to see an effect. If the copper concentration is above background, you don't know. There are some sediments that are showing toxicity down at 10 and 20 and 30 parts per million. And there are some sediments out at 2,000 parts per million, the open circles, which show no toxic effects at all. So once again, we're at this very large orders of magnitude kind of a problem. And again, if we don't understand what's going on, we simply aren't going to be able to do anything about it. The idea of how to deal with sediment toxicity, on slide 9, the model that we use is called the equilibrium partitioning model. And in fact, it is the model that is currently also being used in soil kinds of toxicity studies, as you'll see in a minute. The idea came from some experiments that Bill Adams did when he was at Monsanto with ketones, some of the really early days of toxicity in sediments, from an accidental spill of pesticides into the James Estuary back in the 80s, the early 80s. And Bill had the wonderful idea of looking at the concentration in the water phase of a sediment, the so-called interstitial water or the pore water. Most sediments are 90% water, so you can actually squeeze the water out of a sediment and measure the concentration in the pore water. And what he found remarkably was that if you looked at the LC50 from a water-only exposure, so imagine that you do the experiment on the left-hand side of this figure. Now, this is figure 9. You will see, and you measure the LC50, remarkably what he found was that if you then did the same experiment with sediment in place, and you calculated the LC50 using the pore water concentration, you got essentially the same number. So, the equilibrium partitioning model says that you can predict the toxicity of a chemical in a sediment if you know, that is to say, the right-hand side of it. Problem. Forget the sediment carbon and the equilibrium partitioning for a minute. Just focus on the two arrows that go from pore water to biota and water to biota. Water-only exposures, water to biota. Sediment exposures, pore water to biota. Equilibrium partitioning says that the LC50 will be the same in both cases. A remarkable simplification, which was so interesting and so exciting that when the EPA started to develop sediment criteria. This was the focus of an enormous experimental effort, which is the most of the data of which is presented in figure 10. And at the top panel, is a plot which directly examines whether this idea that you can predict the concentration in pore water that will cause an effect by using the water-only LC50. So if you understand what's going on, if you understand the chemistry in the water system, the fact that the sediment particles are there appears to be irrelevant in the way I'm presenting this. It turns out that's not the case, but in any case, the data speak for themselves. So what's plotted here is the ratio of the water-only LC50 measured separately in a water-only experiment over the pore water concentration. So when those two are equal, you would predict that the mortality, which is plotted on the right hand, on the y-axis, would be at 50%, and those axes do the delineation for you. And you see that the data that's presented here are the ketone data, some PAHs, phenanthrene, fluoranthine, asenaphthene, and two pesticides, each of which three sediments were used in these experiments. And you can see, I think, that within a factor of 2 or 3, this works quite nicely. So you can predict the LC50 in a sediment if you know the concentration in pore water. Now I'm going to go back to slide 9. The idea of equilibrium partitioning is, it's very difficult, by the way, to measure concentrations in pore water. It's hard to do. Nowadays a little easier with biomimetic, you know, solid phase extraction fibers and various techniques, but back in the days when we were doing this, it was almost impossible to make decent measurements in pore water. So the idea was maybe we could predict the concentration in pore water from knowing what the concentration on the solid phase was, and then using an equilibrium calculation, a partition coefficient, to go from the solid phases to the pore water and then predict the LC50 that way. And for hydrophobic chemicals, neutral hydrophobic chemicals of the sort that were on the slide that we just looked at, A partitioning theory does exist. Essentially, the partition coefficient to organic carbon is very close to the octanol water partition coefficient of the chemical. So it turns out that you can predict what the partition is going to look like. So let's look again at slide 10, now the bottom panel. And what's plotted there is the calculation I just described. If you take the sediment concentration, now the total concentration, divided by the fraction organic carbon, that's the FOC, divided by the KOC, the partition coefficient to organic carbon, which is essentially the octanol water partition coefficient of the chemical, that fraction is the predicted LC50 in pore water, and that you divide by the water-only LC50, and you can see again that calculation does a reasonable job. There's more error, of course. You can see that there are some data points that are more scattered because now, of course, we're using a partitioning theory to get there, so there are two models involved and not one, and as a consequence, you know, one expects more uncertainty. The reference on the bottom is the EPA draft technical basis for using these as for making predictions of the toxicity in sediments. So that's how you do it for organic chemicals. It turns out for metals, you have a more complicated situation because the chemistry of metals in pore water, you have to deal with organic matter. And as a consequence, what we've done is applied the biotic ligand model to sediments, and the diagram on slide 11 is simply relabeled from the biotic ligand model that I showed you previously. We simply modeled the sediment organic carbon as humic acid in the WAM formulation. And if you look at slide 12, our ability to predict toxicity of metals in sediments requires that we know two things about the sediments. One is we need to know how much available sulfide is in the sediments, and that's the AVS in the equation, the top equation of the on the left-hand side. You also have to measure not the total metal, but the amount of metal that gets extracted when you actually measure the sulfide. The reason for that is that you if they're really strongly bound metals, you're not going to have any bioavailability. And finally, if you divide by the organic carbon concentration, you can that essentially does the first order partitioning theory. And as you can see from the data plots on the right-hand side, we can predict with almost certainty when there will be no toxicity, both in acute short-term exposures and also in chronic long-term exposures. The nice thing about sediments is you can actually do long-term field kinds of experiments, and most of the data on the chronic toxicity are these kinds of field experiments. And when you exceed something like 100 micromoles per gram organic carbon, we start seeing the incidence of toxicity. So we still can't predict in detail whether things are toxic or not at very high concentrations. You can see in the top panel on the right-hand side, there are data points scattered all over the place, but we do a reasonable job. Pretty good job predicting the onset of toxicity or the lack of toxicity somewhere around 100 micromoles per gram organic carbon. More recently, we have worked out the same thing for soils, and we call it the terrestrial biotic ligand model. On slide 13, it's the same picture, essentially just relabeled. Now we're thinking soils instead of sediments, but the theory is the same. And on slide 14, you see in miniature, at least on my display, a plot of a particular toxicity test for nickel. What you see here is a percent of barley root elongation on the y-axis, and then the plot on the left-hand side is the total nickel concentration for various different soils, and you can see that there's quite a bit of scatter. As you increase the total nickel concentration, eventually the fraction of this is a root. What you do is you measure the length of the root after an incubation period, and the reduction relative to control is what's plotted on the y-axis. If, on the other hand, you use the biotic ligand model and you plot against the fraction of the sites on the biotic ligand that are occupied, you can predict very nicely what happens in soils as you increase the nickel concentration over a wide range of soils. So it works pretty nicely, and on slide 14, you can see a cross plot of predicted EC50s versus observed EC50s for copper and nickel for various kinds of tests that are used to assess metal toxicity in soil, so BRE, barley root elongation, tomato seed generation, photosynthesis potential, glucose respiration, and then two organism tests, Valsoma and Yersinia egg production. So again, the factor of two lines, you can see some scattering, but by and large, we have a pretty good handle on how this works. So in the aquatic systems, things work pretty well. I've got just a couple of quick examples to show you some older examples from the human health world, which I thought would be interesting because this is the National Institutes for Environmental Health Sciences. And so on slide 16 is a set of data from an old experiment, actually my colleague Max Tosca, who's we work on the NYU Superfund basic research project together for many years. It's an experiment that he did in the early 80s. And the first thing they found out was that, so this is a nickel uptake by a Chinese hamster ovary cells in vitro experiment. And the first thing they noticed was that instead of doing the experiments in culture media, which is very complicated stuff, it's very difficult to calculate what the free ion activity is, they did it in saline glucose mixture. That's what the SGM is on the right-hand side. What's plotted on the right-hand side is the data, which is from the paper on the left-hand side, which is a one-hour exposure, the uptake of nickel chloride. And what's plotted simply is the, and what they did was they added various concentrations of amino acids, so aniline, phenaniline, and all the way out to cysteine. And what I've done here is just plotted the, not only the uptake, which is the black bars, and you can see that for the control media by itself, the uptake was close to slightly in excess of 1, but as you added cysteine, which has a sulfur group on it, you get a reduction by almost an order of magnitude. What's plotted in the red are the binding constants between nickel and amino acids. And I think you can see that as the binding constant goes up, specifically for the last two, for histidine and cysteine, that you would expect that the and the amino acids are all at the same concentration, so as the binding constant goes up, the amount of free nickel that's there goes down. And I think you can see very nicely that the free ion activity model would work, I think, very nicely to predict what we're seeing. So that's kind of fun. Here's a more interesting one. This is an older one that's reported in a nice review in Coordination Chemistry Review by Williams, and who I think may be the son of the Williams and the Irving Williams series. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, what's on the left-hand side is a percent of the reduction of the duration of the common cold on the y-axis. And the various concentrations of total zinc in saliva. If you calculate, and that's what they did, if you calculate the activity, I think they calculated it, the activity of divalent zinc and order the data, you can see that there is a nice relationship between, as the zinc concentration activity goes up, that the duration, the percent reduction in a cold goes up, so you're getting better faster, which says that it is the divalent zinc concentration that's doing it, not to the right-hand side, not the total zinc concentration that's doing it on the left-hand side. So again, another example of this free ion activity. And the final slide, slide 18, is a calculation of speciation. This is a theoretical calculation of speciation in wound fluid. Wound fluid is the lymph that exudes out when you have a lesion. And the reason I include this is it's remarkable how different the speciation is of copper, which is on the left-hand side, which is forming complexes, neutral complexes, to two amino acids. So, for example, there's a divalent histidine, and histidine, glutamine, and so on. Whereas for zinc, remarkably, what is predicted to form are very negatively charged anions. So zinc cysteine citrate, for example. very interesting. And in this paper where this calculation is taken from, which, by the way, we have validated. We've redone this calculation, and we get pretty much the same thing. They point out that this must be important. It must be important that one metal is mostly neutral and one metal is mostly anion. Now, they don't know why, and so the paper sort of ends with, you know, people ought to think about it. So I hope this will inspire those of you who do human health in metals to start thinking seriously about looking at free ion activity models and the idea that speciation is really of critical importance. So thank you for your attention, and I think now we're going to do questions. Is that right?
That's correct. Thank you, Dr. DeToro. So now we'll open the phone lines first for some questions. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
And ladies and gentlemen, to signal to ask a question, please also press star 1. Again, star 1 for questions.
This is Ken Finkelstein with NOAA, and I have a question concerning the Canadian sediment criteria. Are you there?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I think the way it was that Dr. DeToro explained this was highly unfair. the sediment criteria, and all these literature sediment criteria, are not meant to be cleanup levels. They're not meant to be they're not meant to meet criteria. I should really say they're meant to be an opportunity for the principal investigator. See, okay, maybe we have 30, 40, 50% chance of toxicity, then go out and do some more study. And to say that you have a 30 or 40% chance of being toxic or 50% chance is the whole point. You need to do more studies. And it's supposed to not be a criteria or a cleanup number. It's supposed to be an opportunity. The principal investigator, as I said, and do more study and to see where those studies should take place.
Fair enough. And I think that if you followed the long conversations that have been held over the years at CPAC meetings between those of us that are interested in what are called mechanistic criteria and those of us that are interested in more empirical criteria, I think what the caller has just said is in fact, in the ideal world, what should happen. But I think it is also fair to say that there are any number of examples where these numbers have been, or numbers like them, have been used for cleanup, and where total concentrations of metals have been used for cleanup. So it isn't quite as black and white. You're absolutely right. That's what you should use them for. They should flag uses, and you should go out and actually try to understand bioavailability, but it is also true, I'm afraid, in the real world that these things are used as cleanup criteria in many cases.
We can stay with the phone lines. If anyone has a question, take your phone off mute and press star 1 to ask a question. Okay, if no one from the phone line is ready to ask a question, I can take a simulcast question from an online participant. This is from Michael Sills from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Sciences, or from Environmental Services. He asks, do you feel there were no electrical double layer effects, for example, measuring zeta potential in determining metal availability in sediment near the sediment-water column interface where metal concentrations might be dilute enough to have a double layer around the soil particle? Clay versus sand.
It's an interesting idea. As you can see from the data presentations, these first order models are really no better than a factor of 2, and in some places, you know, factors of 3 and 4 errors can be seen. And so it may well be that we're seeing micro effects which are not contemplated at all in the models that have been built so far. What's going on really near the sediment-water interface has been something of a contentious point with sediment criteria development, because there is a dilution effect, And as a consequence, especially if organisms are pumping vigorously in their burrows, they may be getting a diluting effect between overlying water and pore water. And the models that are used essentially assume that the organism is entirely being exposed via the sediment. By the way, the sediment experiments using worms follow, so sediment ingestors also follow these rules. So it isn't that pore water is the route of exposure necessarily, it's just a convenient place to try to understand bioavailability. In any case, I think it'd be very interesting to see if you could manipulate the redox potential or manipulate the double layer effects and whatnot and see whether or not that has an effect on toxicity.
Okay, we can stay with the phone lines if there's anyone with a question. Please unmute your phone and press star 1 to ask a question. Make sure you state your name, your organization, please.
Hello? Hello? Yes, we can hear you.
This is Ed Brown from Air Force Center for Engineering and the Environment. My question is on the concentrations that you observed with the amino acids. Are those more of a mechanism of ionic forces that cause irreversible binding, or is it more for larger proteins, for instance, for which the amino acids are components due to conformational structure? Because there seems to be a correlation between the size of the molecule amino acid and the concentration.
Right. Those two things correlate in this sort of an experiment. So you would actually have to analyze the data to see whether or not free ion activity is the only explanation.
Uh-huh.
It could be that as the complex gets larger and larger, it's harder and harder for uptake to occur.
Uh-huh.
But so that is a calculation that, you know, we're going to be doing. So at this stage of the game, I really can't answer that question. It could be both effects. It could be one or the other effect. But it is interesting that the complex incapacity is going up about as much as you're going to need in order to drop the uptake. So roughly, I would guess that it's going to, at least some of the effect will be due to just simply ionic equilibrium and complexation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
We can stay with the phone lines. If anyone has a question, please take your phone off mute. Press star 1, state your name and organization, and ask your question. Okay, let's go to the simulcast lines again. This is a question from Barry Mower from the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. His question is, with EPA proposing ambient water quality criteria for copper based on the BLM model, we are concerned that the amount of total copper allowed to be discharged could increase, thereby increasing the load to the water body and sediment and having a negative impact on sediment biota. What consideration does EPA make or should make to address the sediment loading concern?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. When the biotic ligand model was first being developed, one of the things that was pointed out was that the criteria based on total copper were actually underprotective in some situations. If you remember the copper fathead minnow data, there are a couple of data points down at 1 and 2 micrograms per liter, and those things would not be covered by the original criteria. So it wasn't that the criteria was always overprotective. It was simply not reflective of bioavailability. So if you want to know what the bioavailability and the toxic potential are, the BLM is the way to go. If you have concerns about copper accumulating in places and doing things that are adverse, well, that's a separate issue and I think should be analyzed separately. The question of copper toxicity in sediments, one can analyze that using, again, the sediment BLM or more simplified methods. And if you find out that there is no impact both in the water column and in the sediment, then I think it is reasonable to conclude that that discharge is not having an adverse effect. Simply having a higher concentration of a chemical doesn't necessarily mean that you're having adverse effects. The key idea is that bioavailability controls. If in fact there are situations where the chemical could be mobilized in ways that would be adverse, then again that has to be looked at. The major impact of the bioavailability corrections is to prevent overregulation or over-conservative regulations in places where, in fact, there doesn't appear to be any effect. And if your aim in life is to understand effects, if that's what you're trying to prevent, rather than simply contamination, then using bioavailability as a correction factor is, I think, appropriate. But I'm not advocating that you willy-nilly discharge everything everywhere, so long as it's not bioavailable. If there is a problem that you can understand where the water chemistry changes, for example, a good example of that, well, then you have to think about that. The nice thing about it, though, is that we have the technical tools to understand what's going on. One doesn't necessarily have to then conclude that we're going to use these technical tools in a destructive way. In the early days of these tools, actually, I would be accused of putting machine guns in the hands of children, the idea being that with these tools you could just, you know, pollute the world. That isn't the case at all, I don't think. Of course, you can misuse any tool around, so.
Okay, we can go back to the phone lines. If there's anyone who has a question, please unmute your phone, press star 1, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Yes, this is Steve Glazer from SLG Consulting. How constant do you expect the bioavailability of a particular constituent, copper or anything else, to be in sediment?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the water column, of course, it fluctuates all over the place because the water chemistry is changing, and if you're going to do the calculation right, you have to essentially use models like probabilistic dilution models or what have you to try and understand what the frequency of a toxic event would be. In sediments, the major control is the variability of AVS seasonally, acid volatile sulfide. The acid volatile sulfide, if it's there, and in most sediments that contain even a little bit of organic carbon, you're going to have this sulfide metal, this iron monosulfide is going to be present. It's a very strong binding ligand for metals. Now, that varies quite a lot seasonally because it oxidizes during the summer. It's produced during the spring as organic matter settles to the sediments and becomes oxidized and sulfate gets reduced to sulfide. So there is a substantial change over the year, and this has been looked at. There's a fair literature on the subject. The practical point is that the way to do it is you simply apply the sediment criteria in the coldest times, just before the spring bloom, so January. And if you do that, you're going to hit the most critical situation, and if you haven't got a problem at that time, it's likely that you're not going to have a problem throughout the year. But it is something you have to think about. It does vary.
We can stay with the phone lines. If anyone has a question, please unmute your phone, press star 1, and state your name and organization.
Hello, this is Shelton Zhang with Wisconsin DNR. Dr. Victoria, I have a question. Have you considered about the uncertainties of sampling and the analysis in sediment samples that could attribute to the variation in the development of a criteria?
Yeah, the sediments are notoriously variable. If you go out and sample them, anyone who knows, who's actually done field work, knows that you can get quite a variation in concentrations of the metals and of the binding ligands and so on. And in which case, you simply have to make enough measurements so that you're fairly sure of what's going on. Most of the data that we have are in situations where the variability is kept to a minimum because the sediments are either intentionally contaminated or are laboratory experiments where you know the amount of material that you've added, and so the measurements just confirm. There's a problem with that, and in fact I should mention that there's a very nice volume that is a CTAC publication, the Society for Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. It's a volume that was published, I think, last year, if memory serves, on a conference that was held. The editor is Rick Winning, I think, and a few other folks. In any case, you can find it on the CTAC website. And it's a compilation of lots of papers, discussion of mechanistic criteria, equilibrium partitioning, empirical criteria, the Canadian approaches and those approaches like that. I think a very nice discussion of which is appropriate when. If I sound like I'm on one side of the argument, for many years I've been on one side of the argument, so it's hard for me to change. But I regard that document as sort of the Treaty of Pelston, where we finally settled our differences. And there's a very nice chapter on measurements as well, which is what brought it to mind. So for those of you who want to follow it in more detail, that would be a good reference.
We have time for one more question, and I will take it from the online participant. This is from Maung Thun from B2G in Calgary. The question is, I'm just wondering if there is any influence of pH in the media on bioavailability as there is in plants.
Yes, there is. There are two effects. One effect is the change in speciation as protons compete with other cations to bind up ligands. So as you increase the pH, typically you get more complexation. There is also a direct effect of protons occupying the biotic ligand. If you look at figure, for example, 13, you will see that in the cation competition circle near the top, protons are listed. They're very strong acids, as you know, and as a consequence, they can also bind to the biotic ligand. And so it works on both sides. It's a very important constituent of both the aquatic chemistry, how the partitioning works to organic carbon and to ligands, and also the direct effect of cation competition. And the terrestrial BLM attempts to account for both of those effects. The soils that were tested have a wide range in pH, from 4 up to 7 or 8, and so those effects are, in fact, part of the data set.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Toro. That is all the time we have for questions. So I will now turn the time over to Aaron Yao, Environmental Health Scientist, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, to introduce the next speaker. Aaron.
Our second speaker today is Dr. Nick Basta, Professor of Soil Environmental Chemistry at The Ohio State University. Dr. Basta has a very active research program focused on risk-based environmental chemistry and bioavailability of contaminants in soil, with emphasis on human, agronomic, and ecosystem pathways. The title of his talk today is Assessing Oral Contaminant Human Bioavailability in Soil with In Vitro Gastrointestinal Methods, Uncertainties, Data Gaps, and Research Needs. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Basta.
Thank you, Aaron. Can you hear me now?
I'm great. Go ahead.
You're okay? Okay. Well, warm greetings from Columbus, where it's a nice sunny day. I'm sure nobody could see that except me, but it is a nice sunny day. I want to thank Superfund Basic Research Program for the opportunity to deliver a presentation and USC. And I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Kirk Shekel from National Risk Management Research Lab in Cincinnati, and Dr. Karen Bradham from National Exposure Research Laboratory in RTP. I'm on slide 19 now, and I'm about to go to slide 20. So please go to slide 20. Today's topic is focusing on soil contaminant oral bioavailability, this pathway. Specifically, how do we make adjustments for bioavailability, especially to children? How do we measure bioavailability to children? One method to get the bioavailability term is to use animal model dosing trials. These tend to be very expensive trials. They could be $25,000, $50,000 a soil. They're lengthy. They could take weeks to months. You may have to wait months to be able to get your soil analyzed. And it takes some time to crunch the numbers and make the data available. So it's not easily obtainable data. I'm going to slide 21. So one solution is to use an inexpensive, fast alternative, namely in vitro methods, in vitro gastrointestinal methods, in lieu of the animal models. These methods are essentially sequential extractions. They're simulated in a laboratory. All of these methods have a stomach phase, and then some have an intestinal phase following the stomach phase. Some actually divide the intestinal phases into several compartments. So they go from a very simple stomach to a stomach plus maybe multiple intestinal phases. The National Academy of Sciences defines bioavailability as the form of a contaminant that can be absorbed into a living organism's systemic circulation. Only the in vivo models can actually measure contaminant bioavailability. You need to have a living organism to measure contaminant bioavailability. The in vitro methods aren't going to give you an absolute bioavailability number, but they can measure the bioaccessible contaminant. And the bioaccessible can be defined as the dissolved contaminant in the GI tract in a chemical form that can be absorbed in the systemic circulation. In that definition, bioaccessibility is going to be all the dissolved contaminant. Bioavailable, only a small amount of the bioaccessible is usually bioavailable. So bioaccessibility is going to be larger than bioavailability. So the in vitro method, bioaccessibility, assumes worst case, meaning if it's dissolved, it's going to be absorbed. So in a way, it's kind of a conservative measure. Going to slide 22. There are a variety of different IVG. I'll use that abbreviation for in vitro gastrointestinal. I get tired of saying it. But types of IVG methods, there's a variety. And you can group them based on the type of contaminant that of interest. And it's usually grouped by inorganic contaminant methods or organic contaminant methods. There's some methods that have been designed for inorganics such as lead, arsenic, nickel, or cadmium, or organic contaminants such as dioxins, furans, pH, pesticides. There are other IVG methods can also be grouped on the type of the method or the complexity of the method. You could have a very simple batch method versus a dynamic complex method. Batch means everything is done in one beaker. The stomach, the intestinal phases, everything is done in one beaker. The dynamic means that you're actually moving your extract from one compartment to the other. For example, if you look on the left-hand side of the slide, you'll see the OSU IVG method or the SBRC or RBALP are batch methods. Everything is done in one vessel. The SHIME method on the right side of the slide, there's actually five compartments there. The first one is stomach, the second is small intestine, and the last three are the colon. And so solution is actually moved, and soil material moved from one compartment to the other, just as it is with your GI tract. That's a very complicated system. You have to regulate flows between vessels, etc. Going to slide 23. So people ask me, well, how many of these methods are around? There's about a dozen methods right now that are being used and materials being published on. There's more actually being developed as we speak, and I know some of the people developing them. So what I picked out just a few that people are somewhat familiar with. The PBET follow-up RBALP by Ruby Den Drexler, which is a batch fasting method. Our method, which is a batch fasting method, and you can notice that the RIVM or OMINS, that's a batch fed method. So you actually see some fasting and some non-fasting methods. Fasting meaning there isn't any food at all in the in vitro method. The non-fasting are actually fed. The RIVM method, it's milk powder. Milk powder is added. Some methods, when it comes to the in vitro methods, the fasting methods, pH becomes really important when you're measuring bioaccessibility of inorganics such as lead and arsenic, because pH is really controls the dissolution of the matrix. But when you look at if you're looking at organic contaminants, and especially if you're in a fed situation, bile becomes a very critical determiner of what your bioaccessibility is going to be. More bile usually means more dissolution of food particles that may have pH absorbed to them, and so you get a higher dissolved pH, higher pH reading. Moving to slide 24. So instead of just presenting my views, I've decided to present a summary of a special symposium that was held last year at the International Society of Exposure. And this symposium focused on data gaps and research needs for IVG methods. Slide 25. Last year was a big year. Not only did we have the meeting, but last year, US EPA published guidance for evaluating oral bioavailability of metals in soils for use in human health risk assessment. This is really an important criteria to establish criteria for the determination of what methods are acceptable for measuring bioavailability or bioaccessibility. One part I want to focus on is the quote in the black text, that the data generated adequately measures or predicts the toxic endpoint of interest and demonstrates a linkage between either a new test method and effects in a target species. Or to paraphrase that in the red text, the IVG method must be correlated with an acceptable in vivo model, and the IVG method must be predictive. This is really important. There is quite a bit of work in the literature where in vivo models, the IVG methods are reported, bioaccessibility is reported, but the authors have not correlated with an acceptable in vivo model. So this is a very important criteria that EPA put into this guidance document. So then that begs the next question. If we go to slide 26. What's an acceptable in vivo model? If we're going to develop an in vitro model and correlate with an acceptable in vivo model, what is the gold standard here, the in vivo model? Well, what's the target organism in a sense? Well, it would be children. But we get a very accurate bioavailability that way, but we're not going to use that model. So what are we going to use? Immature swine have been developed and used as an acceptable model for lead, arsenic, and measuring other bioavailability. This method's actually been accepted by EPA according to their guidance for lead, and arsenic is under consideration. Primate is an acceptable model for bioavailability. The primate model tends to be expensive, and there's also ethical issues that pigs don't have, swine don't have, food animals don't have the same issues as primates. And then we have rats or mice, different lines of mice. And this is a little further removed, whether or not this is acceptable bioavailability measurement. It is inexpensive, and there's been a lot of recent developments on improvements on use of this model, especially for arsenic. And actually, Dave Thomas from EPA RTP presented some of this work at the International Society for Exposure. Okay, slide 27 is showing you the RBALP method. In 2007, EPA passed guidance on the use of this method, the RBALP, to estimate relative bioavailability of lead in soil and soil-like contaminated media. And this method, developed and reported by Drexler and Bratton, it's a published method, shows a very nice correlation and predictive between the RBA for lead measured by swine and their in vitro method. And this is the type of thing we're looking for. So we have this for lead. So now if you go to slide 28, what do we have for arsenic? Well, using the same approach, we've actually developed a method, an IVG gastric IVG method, that correlates well with relative bioavailability for arsenic using the in vivo swine model. This was actually a study we conducted some time ago, but we've been refining the method, and the method works well. There are a few other in vitro methods out there that also measure bioaccessible arsenic, and they have been shown to be correlated with relative bioavailable arsenic using immature swine or primate models. So there are a few methods that have shown promise. We actually use this method for 14 contaminated soil and soil-like materials. So please go to slide 29. Just a little more information on our method, the OSHU IVG. It's simulated GI extraction, two steps. First is gastric, and then the second is intestinal. So we actually get two measures, the bioaccessibility of arsenic in the gastric phase and then the bioaccessibility of arsenic in the intestinal phase. This method was developed thanks to funding from US EPA-ORD. Our research led to the development of this model in collaboration with Dr. Stan Castile. And Dr. Castile is director of the Veterinary Medicine Diagnostic Lab at the University of Missouri. He did the immature swine dosing trials and produced the arsenic RBA values. We published the original method in as Rodriguez et al., 1999, in ES&T. And recently we've published a method that is a little more simplified. It shows a good correlation, and that's Pasta et al., 2007, in JEHS. And I'd be happy to give, if anybody wants reprints of this work, I'd be happy to send them to them. Maybe even post them on a website. Slide 30. We started working with this method back in 1996. Work is still going on after 10 years. And to show that point, if you see these children on the left there in 1997, they were actually my graduate student's children. And so I contacted them, and I said, could you get made the same type of picture 10 years later, just to make the point that we've been doing this for quite a while. And he actually sent me this picture of the kids in the same pose. He told me it was a lot easier to get the picture in 97 than it was in 2007. But I just want to let everybody know that we've done work on this for quite a while. The soil isn't contaminated. this was posed with clean soil. Slide 31. Another method that shows is the another method that actually has correlation of an IVG method measuring bioaccessibility with relative bioavailable arsenic is that of Lowney's. Yvette Lowney from Exponent has shown a correlation of what they call a CERTIP method. And this is a in vitro method that they correlated with primate RBA arsenic. The CERTA method measures gastric bioaccessibility, and they take two measurements actually. It's actually two, they run the test twice, one with glycine at pH, and that should read pH 2.5. There's an error on this slide. Please correct it. It should read 0.4 molar HCl pH 2.5. So it's pH 2.5 with glycine or 0.4 molar phosphate, pH 2.5. So the CERTIP method determines two bioaccessibilities, and then you use the larger bioaccessibility of two methods. Please go to slide 32. Here's the results from Dr. Lowney's method showing the correlation between arsenic bioaccessibility and arsenic bioavailability. And you can tell it's a nice correlation. This is actually either the maximum of the glycine or the phosphate measured at pH 2.5. Go to slide 33. So we've been talking about measuring bioaccessibility of lead or arsenic, and then if you find a method that works, the next question is, can we use the same method for different contaminants? We have other contaminants on the site. We've actually looked at using our method for arsenic. We developed it for arsenic, but then we used the same method for lead and found that we had good correlations with for lead between in vivo and bioaccessible lead. And we could also use the same method for cadmium. So we could look at bioaccessibility and relative bioavailable cadmium. So some of these methods actually have potential to go beyond the element they were designed for, and that shows some promise. Okay, let's go to slide 34. So everybody has a small set of soils they work with usually when they do these correlation studies, and then the question becomes, will their method work for other contaminated soils? So you go back and look at the original soils or studies that people work on, and we find out that a lot of these soils they use are from highly contaminated wastes. For example, usually over many of these soils are over 2,000 part per million contaminant of concern. From the guidance document estimating RBA of lead in soil and soil-like materials, most of the 19 soil-like solid waste materials were from smelter origin. The lead content ranged from 1,500 to 14,000 part per million, median 7,200 part per million. In our work that we were working with arsenic-contaminated soils, we had 14 soils. They ranged from 233 to 17,000 part per million, median 1,460 part per million arsenic. But my point here is a lot of these soils were fairly highly contaminated. Let's go to slide 35. So the question is, will these in vitro tests that have been developed for highly contaminated smelter media, can they be used for all other types of contaminated media or soil? For example, if someone says, well, you developed it for, your test shows it worked for mining waste contaminated soil, will it work for soil that's contaminated with lead batteries or paint or coal ash? And the first thing you stop and ask yourself is, do we have to do validation studies for each one of these sources? Do we have to go out and get 14 soils that are contaminated with paint and show that the in vitro method can measure bioaccessible lead correlated with the in vivo lead for just paint contaminated soils? If that's the case, it's going to take us many years. A better approach is actually to speciate the contaminants in the soil and see what form of these contaminants are bioavailable or measured by the IVG method. There are a variety of contaminant speciation methods, and some people have used these techniques in their in vitro work. And John Drexler has used SEM EDEX for contaminant speciation for lead, and Kirk Scheckel, EPA, has done quite a bit of contaminant speciation using spectroscopy, including XFs. So if you have a feel for what species is controlling bioavailability, then you may be a little more confident using this method for different soils with different contaminations. I should mention, in addition to the advanced spectroscopic methods, there's a wide variety of time-tested, readily available wet chemical methods that you can do in your labs easily. These contaminant speciation in dirty media like soil or some of these waste materials is very tricky, and the results can be very ambiguous. So it is very important, usually, to have a combination of contaminant speciation methods, spectroscopic and extractions, and this way you have independent lines of evidence to figure out which form of, which species of contaminant you have in your soil. If you could figure out which species you have, then you could try to figure out if it's bioavailable or not, and does your in vitro method measure the form that's bioavailable. Let's go to slide 36. This slide shows solid phase contaminant speciation for arsenic for soils that we used in our OSU IVG method. And you can see the arsenic was identified in their soils as scorodite or a Jarosat analog, and it's inversely related to the relative bioavailability in the swine model. So this gives us some assurance that we're actually measuring a form that's correlated with the animal's uptake of this contaminant. If we go to slide 37, we can extrapolate the OSU IVG method then to from highly contaminated smelter waste to soils or solid waste that have predominantly scorodite or jarosite arsenic analogs as their source term. So if we know the contaminant speciation, and if we know the in vitro is measuring this, we may not have to do these correlation studies for every different contaminant source, just speciate it and realize that if we're looking at the same type of contaminant source in different soils, our method will probably be valid. Let's go to slide 38. If you look at contaminant concentration solid soil and solid waste, I mentioned earlier, some of these were really highly contaminated soils. But then we have soils that are moderately contaminated, which might be a few factors of multiples of background concentration. If you have a soil that has 7,000 part per million total arsenic or lead, highly contaminated, are you really going to make an adjustment to that soil using bioavailability? The bioavailability is going to be extremely low to make an adjustment, so that site may not require excavation and cleanup. However, if the soil was moderately contaminated, say 300 part per million of arsenic, or between 400 and 2,000 part per million lead, then bioavailability might be applicable and give you a reasonable adjustment. The point being, it's more likely for an adjustment to be made for bioavailability or bioaccessibility on a moderately contaminated soil than a highly contaminated one. Slide 39. And I believe this is where the in vitro methods may have their greatest application. The greatest application may actually be to assess risks for soils with moderate level of contamination. Soils that are contaminated with lead paint that contain 600-700 part per million lead, or arsenical pesticides, or coal ash, or CCA, or cattle dips that use arsenates, etc. There's a lot greater extent and area for these moderately contaminated soils that need assessment in urban and old industrial sites. Then there are probably on a smaller number of sites with higher level of contamination. Slide 40. The other issue I wanted to point out with is the detection level, the method detection limits, meaning the in vivo method detection limits and the versus the in vitro detection limits, and the contaminant levels we're seeing in soil. Most of the in vivo studies require highly contaminated soil, meaning over 500 to 5,000 part per million of contaminant. When you get down to low levels, moderately contaminated soil levels, it becomes difficult for in vivo methods to actually give you an accurate bioavailability. If you're below, I don't know of any methods that can measure below 100 part per million arsenic with in vivo models, yet this is the area where we're worried right now. We're looking at soils that contain 60, 50, 70 part per million arsenic and possible cleanup. So it might be below the in vivo working range, but it's easily measured by the in vitro methods. In vitro methods could go down to 1 part per million arsenic. So a strong advantage of the in vitro methods is the ability to estimate bioavailability from moderately contaminated levels. And this may be the place where you get the greatest utility of this method. Slide 41. And now this is going on a limb a little. Are we confident to use these in vitro methods to estimate contaminant bioavailability for moderately contaminated soils. Are we confident enough just to use in vitro methods without any in vivo at the low concentrations? And I would say yes, but we have to know the chemical speciation of these soils. For example, is the contaminant species in the old orchard soil the same as the species in the smelter soil where the in vivo data was available and the correlation study was done? If that's the case, then we might be willing to go to very low concentrations in an orchard soil where we don't have or can't get in vivo data. Slide 42. Last thing I want to hit on is the soil type affect bioavailability, meaning should soil type be considered in the development or acceptance of these methods? Is it important to have a range of soils in a bioavailability study? We know that soil chemistry greatly affects contaminant sequestration and bioavailability, bioaccessibility. And you could think of it as this diagram shows in slide 42. If you take the total contaminant in soil, soil chemical properties, pH, oxides, clay, can partition a contaminant into available and unavailable pools. Go to slide 43. This slide is showing us a study that we did with 22 soils. These soils were spiked all with the same amount of arsenic. They all contained 250 part per million arsenic. They were aged over a long time. And then we grew lettuce on them and looked at phytotoxicity. And you can see the percent relative growth in the graph goes all the way from 0% to 70%. So the correction is huge. The soils on the right that were growing 70, 60%, they had the ability to sequester arsenic, making it unavailable. Less toxicity. The soils on the left, Bernot, Canisteo, Dennis, are sandier soils. They didn't sequester any arsenic. So there was no growth at all. Everything was dead. And the picture on the right, there's the thousand words right there. The healthy plants that are growing, they're all growing in the same concentration of arsenic. It's just the soil property modifying the availability. And we've published this work for earthworms and for lettuce on these soils. Similar results for earthworms. So if you go to slide 44, then the question is, what happens if you ingest these soils? And it goes through your gastrointestinal system. Does the IVG method sensitive to the soil properties, and does it modify the arsenic bioaccessibility? And the answer is yes, it does modify the arsenic bioaccessibility. So soil properties can affect in vitro gastrointestinal arsenic. In fact, we have a multiple regression for some of the data for those 22 soils. We took those and soils and used the OSU IVG and found that percent saturation of the iron oxides in the soil and pH were the two main variables to describe the bioaccessible arsenic in these soils. And this is similar to other work that was published by Yang, Barnett, Jardine, and et al. In ESMT. So it is important for the IVG method to measure bioaccessibility in contaminated soils with a wide range of soil chemical properties. We want the method to be robust enough that if we took soils from Colorado or Pennsylvania or Florida, with wide range of soil properties, the method would work. Slide 45. So, in summary, I started with the guidance, EPA guidance, and part of the guidance says a detailed protocol for the test method, blah, 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 and then it says, and a description of the known limitations in the method, including the description of the class of materials that the test can or cannot accurately assess. This is so critical. It's really important to know when the method doesn't work. And so how are we going to provide that information, a description of known limitations of these tests? I think we have to use contaminant speciation, provide information whether these methods have been correlated with in vivo models for the contaminant species in the test material. And also, we should know something about the soils. We should know the soil chemical parameters that affect bioavailability that were in the soils that were tested. slide 46. As far as uncertainties, data gaps, and research needs, we need research leading to the acceptance of existing and new in vivo models. That's the first thing. We have to have this in vivo model issue sorted out. Document the relationship between arsenic speciation, bioaccessibility, and bioavailability. Test the use of these methods, the soil chemical and speciation methods, to support IVG data when IVG is the only option, which means we have to have some speciation methods go hand in hand when we don't have any in vivo data with IVG methods. And also, we need to be testing a wide range of soils with a wide range of soil chemical properties to make sure these methods hold up. So, slide 47. Thank you for your attention. Please feel free to contact me for any further information. That, I'll turn it over for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Bhakta. So, now we'll turn the time over to questions. We will first go to the phone lines. If you would like to ask Dr. Bhakta a question, please take your phone off mute, press star 1, and state your name and organization. Okay, to get things rolling, I will ask a question from one of the online participants. This one should be familiar to you. It's a former student, Damon Wright. He is with Magellan Midstream Partners, LP in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He said, do you know if EPA or another state agency has allowed the use of these in vitro methods for developing site-specific cleanup standards and or regulatory closure of an impacted site?
Hi, Damon. Thanks for your call. Yes, not too far from Tulsa, actually. These methods have been used. Bioaccessibility methods have been used. In fact, they were used in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, to make adjustments for cadmium years ago. It wasn't our method, but it was an in vitro method. So they have been used. They're becoming more common. But they're very on a site-specific basis, and they're not widespread. So we're trying to do is get them validated and get them more widespread and beyond the site-specific studies. Okay.
Thank you. We can go back to the phone lines. If you have a question for Dr. Bhakta, please take your phone off mute, press star 1, and state your name and organization.
Aaron Yao, US EPA. Hey, Dr. Bhakta. For the OSU IVG method, I was just curious as to whether you have tested any more soils apart from the 14 for that method, and if so, do you know what your limitations are for those, as well as what classes of materials those can and cannot accurately assess?
It's an excellent question. Actually, Aaron, we have tested it for more soils. We've tested it for lower concentration arsenical pesticides with a range in properties, and it appears to be working well, meaning it's correlated with an animal model. In fact, the correlation is the slope is almost 1. We haven't published that yet. So we have a few follow-up studies we haven't published. We've had, I guess the one thing about these methods is we've had a few materials that you can have quite a bit of variability because the dissolution of the matrix is tricky. We've had a few slag materials that you can get quite a bit of variability with. And so in that case, you probably want to do 3 or 4 determinations to get a handle on that variability, to get a good estimate. So sometimes I don't think it's the method per se being inaccurate, but it could be that if you only took 1 or 2 measurements, you would get a data point that looked like it didn't fit. Are we going to find cases it fails? Yeah, I think we will. Have we found it yet? Not yet. We're still looking. We'll run into a few yet. We have a few ugly points on our graphs. that we're trying to understand better. But we haven't found... Now, I should qualify this. Everything we've worked with is arsenic 5, arsen 8. And so that makes our life a little easier. We're talking about one form of arsenic. And so if we were dealt, if somebody gave us organic forms of arsenic or elemental arsenic, we're not sure how this method would perform. That help?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, let's stay with the phone line. If you have a question, take your phone off mute, press star 1, and state your name and organization.
Steve Johnson, Delaware Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay, thank you. I'm thinking about how to use this information. At some time in the past, men and women in white coats administered poison to rats and observed the results. So if we're going to use a bioavailability factor now, don't we need to know what the bioavailability was of the what the rats were ingesting, for instance?
Yeah, I guess you do. I mean, to me, they're two different extremes here. You're probably talking about acute toxicity from a high dose versus a lower dose. I imagine if the arsenic that was fed to rats was fairly soluble, if it was something like arsenic trioxide or some fairly soluble form, the bioavailability might have been close to 100%. In many of the soils that we deal with, the bioaccessibility or bioavailability values are well below 50%, some cases below 20%. So I guess the best place to make these adjustments would be in soils where the contaminant you find the bioavailability is much lower than 100%. And also, I would say to moderately contaminated soils. You know, so there's a big difference between, in my mind, between the rat poison that's highly soluble and bioavailable, and the moderately or low contaminated soil where the bioavailability is very low. The exposures would be a lot different. I'm not sure what your background level is of arsenic in Delaware, or how you what kind of guidelines you got for that, or how you evaluate it. But where I'm at in Central Ohio, our background's about 20 part per million arsenic, and so if we assumed it was all available, we would have a serious problem. Luckily, it's very low bioavailability, below 10%, some cases below 2%. And I guess that's where I see this being applied more, at the moderate concentrations rather than the rat poison levels.
Dr. Basta, this is Aaron. Let me see if I can help a little bit.
Okay.
Basically, what we're looking at is relative bioavailability. So you're absolutely right. We do need to know what not necessarily the absolute bioavailability that was used in the toxicity study, but we are using that toxicity value. And so what typically is done in the animal studies is they administer the, and I think with arsenic, it's the arsenic in water. So they use something fairly soluble, such as sodium arsenate. And what they do is they dose the swine with that, and then they'll dose the swine with the actual soil and do a ratio there. So they're actually looking at the relative bioavailability. That way you can do the adjustment to the toxicity value.
Okay.
Okay, we can stay with the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, press star 1, and state your name and organization and ask your question.
This is Frank Hitson calling from Shaw Environmental in Houston.
Okay.
Go ahead with your question, please.
I'm wondering if you've looked at some of the, by now, pretty old data from the 50s and 60s on radio tracer studies with usually fission products. And their uptake, usually in mammalian species, from either food or water. the advantage of those data are that because the isotopes were radioactive, they could be detected at very low mass concentrations, and it might help you extend some of your research if you could use some of those isotopes.
That's very interesting. Which isotopes?
Well, almost any of them. A lot of lead isotopes, lead-212.
Oh, okay.
Lead isotopes. I'm not so sure about arsenic, but certainly chromium, cesium, barium, a lot of those. I think if you get into some of the older literature that came out of Pacific Northwest Labs up in Washington, Argonne National Labs, and several universities that back in the day were studying those. And, in fact, there was a time when people used to joke that the definition of a radionuclide was something which, when injected into a rat, generated a paper. Anyway, there's a lot of data that might help you, especially a lot of work on gastric uptake. That data showed very strikingly the effect of fasting. The data extends to quite a bit because one of the things they were concerned with was not only uptake, but distribution among organs and excretion. So you could find information about what was administered and what was excreted over time and get that particular dimension of what was really available and uptake. So all I'm saying is, you know, you could get into some of that older data and find some ways to both, I think, extend your method and calibrate it as well, especially at lower concentrations.
That's very interesting. If you have any specific articles in mind, send them my way. I'd appreciate it.
I'll try to do that. And but like I say, you might go to somebody at Ohio State and talk to a radiochemist. He can probably direct you just as well, but I'll be glad to do that.
Yeah, I know the... some of the radionuclides are, and it's interesting, the uptake was very, very small.
Exactly,
compared to the total. And that's important to know. And I guess in a sense, that's why with this bioaccessible measurement with the in vitro, we feel we're being a little, we're being conservative in that if it's only 3% absorption of cesium per se, and where we assume 100% is available for absorption.
Oh, yes, it's very striking. In fact, it's extremely dependent on chemical form and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you'd be astonished at some of the studies that were done. Sometimes they would take these radionuclides and fuse them into glass so that they would be essentially completely insoluble.
Yeah, vitrification.
And so on. And there's just a lot of work done, you know, probably before 1975. So anyway,
that's good analogy. It's good information. And we could probably borrow, quite a bit from that. And it's interesting, the gastrointestinal chemistry, I'm a soil chemist, but, you know, the gastrointestinal chemistry gets really fascinating.
Uh-huh. One thing, if I could, extend this question a little bit, a lot of, when you're talking about soil impact, a lot of arsenic species, for example, will bind to ferric and ferric ions, and so you might be getting arsenic attached to iron, and tracking it that way.
Yes, in fact, that is one of the main sinks in soil systems. We've done a lot of work with ferrihydrite, and even as a remediation technology, if you have a soil that the ones I showed you before that were very soluble and high in arsenic, it's because there isn't enough amorphous or reactive iron in the system. And so you could add iron oxide, or it becomes a remediation technology. Some people have injected ferric chloride, raised the pH, made iron oxide to sequester arsenic.
Uh-huh.
But it's really interesting because in the soil chemistry site, we really know quite a bit about what will absorb and precipitate and occlude these contaminants. What we don't know is whether that'll hold. You know, we know quite a bit about pore water and plant uptake or earthworms. What we don't know is what happens in the GI tract. Will that matrix redissolve and become available again?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, We published some work recently. One of my graduate students, Doug Beek, had done some work with ferry hydrite, absorbed the arsenic, and a good percentage, in fact, large percentages, over 80%, 90% of the arsenic absorbed the ferry hydrate did not get dissolved in the IVG to simulation. So that's really an idea of how good of a sink some of these contaminants are. And for lead, there's also, it's very well known, phosphates, pyromorphites, and some other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all I have, and good luck to you.
Well, thanks.
Okay, we've got another question from an online participant. This is from Austin Cooley of Brown and Caldwell of Houston, Texas. His question is, the two commercial laboratories that I know of that can speciate arsenic can only speciate inorganic arsenic forms and cannot speciate organic arsenic. What effect does this have on examining bioaccessibility? In other words, how do you handle organic arsenic species in assessing bioaccessibility?
That's a good question. Most of the materials we've worked, it's been oxidized inorganic arsenic. We haven't really seen significant amounts of organic arsenic. If you do get into organic arsenic forms, and they're not oxidized, that's going to take a whole different speciation scheme than some of the inorganic ones that he's probably mentioning. You may have to get into extraction techniques followed by chromatography techniques versus solid phase speciation techniques. We haven't gone that direction because we really haven't seen the material yet, but if people do see organic forms, there are some good food methods. You're almost going to use methods that have been used for food chemistry to speciate and fractionate the arsenic into different forms. So we haven't done that, but there are methods out there that can be used that have been developed mainly for assessing the form of arsenic contaminants and other contaminants in foods. Does that kind of answer a little?
let's take another online question. This is from Jimmy Sparrow, ETSD, California EPA in Sacramento. This is a comment. He said, in regard to the in vivo new models, he wanted to point out that this frog dolly rat was selected for high resistance to arsenic trioxide early in its development as frog dolly. So it would be advisable to use a different rat strain for testing the in vivo bioavailability in rats.
Yes, I get. I'm not a rat man, but I believe that's what the approach has been. I think at RTP, it's to use a different line, specifically in the concerns that he'd mentioned. So people are looking at development of different lines. But I'm not an expert in this area, and so there are people who are actively working. I mentioned Dave Thomas at RTP; he's one of them.
Let's go back to the phone line. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, press star 1, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Please go ahead with your question.
This is Charlene Liu, CDM.
Yes.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay, I have a question. Actually, I have two questions. First is, have you worked with lead arsenic, and especially from historical release, and you found, like, if it's become less soluble once it's been released into the environment? And the second question is about I know you talked mainly about oral bioavailability. What about the inhalation route? Do we have any study in that area?
I could take the second one first. I don't work with inhalation per se, but there has been quite a bit of work in the inhalation route. And I'm trying to remember, Pat Rasmussen has done quite a bit with inhalation work in Health Canada, and house dust and different forms and species of lead in house dust, and what the bioavailability is from the inhalation pathway. But I don't work in that area per se. The lead arsenate's an interesting issue. It is very insoluble. It has been used as a pesticide historically, so it's a historical contaminant, and it becomes a contaminant that's found on old orchards, like apple orchards. I'm not aware of too many studies that have actually focused on in vitro, in vivo correlation data for soils that are contaminated with lead arsenic from orchard soils. I know those soils are out there and people have worked with them, but I don't believe they've ever been part of, or I shouldn't say any of them, but we haven't seen a lot of them used in dosing trials. And so that's another interesting contaminant matrix that I wonder just how will it fit? Will an in vitro method be able to predict what an animal is seeing from this very insoluble matrix? Actually, my guess would be it would, because these in vitro methods tend to become more accurate as the contaminant becomes more insoluble. And so lead arsenate would be so insoluble, I would think that it would be, that this would be a soil contaminant with lead arsenic would be a good fit for in vitro methods as far as being correlated with animal models. Okay? Is that?
Yes, okay, thank you.
Oh, okay.
Would you repeat that, Pat? What's her last name again in Health Canada?
Rasmussen. If you send me an email, I can send you her contact information.
Okay, I would do that, thank you.
And actually, she was at this International Society for Exposure Assessment. She was co-chairing the symposium. So I could, she'd be happy to hear from you.
Okay, thank you.
I think we have time for one quick comment and another question from the online participants. The quick comment is directed more to a question that was asked earlier. Yvette Lowney from Exponent in Boulder, Colorado says, you might point out that the individual asking about the bioavailability of arsenic in the toxicity research for arsenic, the toxicity values are based on human exposure to arsenic in drinking water. Also, it is very important to point out that the values this research conducts is directed at relative bioavailability. So that may help the
yes.
previous question.
Yes.
And the next question is from John Christopher, ETSD, California EPA, Sacramento. He says, UHAS et al. In Australia seem to be achieving a lower limit of detection for arsenic in the in vivo swine model. They are measuring arsenic in blood instead of using the ratio of urinary excretion fraction. Do you have a comment?
It's a good question from John. I've read some of Albert's work, and I like their technique. The work looks very nice, and they're one of the few groups that have done this. They've actually gone and looked at blood and arsenic. I think you could lower the detection limit, but I know you get to a point where it becomes extremely difficult because you're dealing with background arsenic. And so even when you get below 50 part per million, for example, of arsenic or in that vicinity, you wind up with high values mainly because your background levels are high. So in that case, the animal model has a problem just running into background. I'm not sure what their blood background looks like, how that compares to urine, so maybe that's how they're getting lower. But I would imagine that would be a nice technique with the swine model to go lower. Maybe that's a technique for us to look at the low end. Maybe we should be using swine using blood, and it would give us that correlation data lower at lower concentrations so we could develop the in vitro models. Worth looking at. And by the way, the Australians are very active these days, as are the Canadians, as are the Europeans. Next week, the Bioavailability Research Group of Europe will be meeting in Milan, Italy. They always meet in such nicer places than we do. But there's a lot of activity in this topic, and I think we're going to see much better developments along Dr. Kuantz's work in Australia. So some of these problems we may be overcoming, allowing us to go to very, very low levels of contaminants and get correlation data.
Thank you, Dr. Bassa. I would like to take a few minutes here at the end to open up questions to both presenters. However, before we open the question and answer session to both presenters, I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of the last two slides. Slide 48 links to the SBRP Risky Learning page, where you can find links to the next seminars, and slide 49 contains links to the additional resources page where we have assembled resources that are directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism. Again, links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. So for the next few minutes, I will open the question and answer period to either presenter. If you have a question, take your phone off mute, press star 1, state your name and organization, and ask your question. Okay, I can go to the simulcast lines again. This is a question from June Ma at CDM Edison, New Jersey. Were any tests done to compare the, this is for Dr. Bassa. Were any tests done to compare the in vitro extraction results with results of traditional extraction method like sequential extraction or somewhat total mass method, example method 6150B?
We've actually have looked at a variety of different, maybe not that EPA method, but we have looked at a variety of different extraction methods and to see which one's more or less predictive for arsenic. We actually have a publication in 2003, Rodriguez et al. 2003, where we compare different soil extraction techniques with the in vivo data to see if we could find something as predictive as the in vitro method. We didn't. Actually, the in vitro method turned out to be more predictive than these other fractionation methods. But we did find some fractionation methods that were close. The methods that actually desorbed arsenic from the surfaces, I'm thinking of one that we used, which was a hydroxylamine hydrochloride. Hydrochloride was a pretty good extractant. So this got a partial dissolution of the iron plus easily desorbed from the soil surface. What I like about the extraction methods is when we actually use one, we get a feel for what we're measuring. And so, but it gives us some information, like I just mentioned with the in vitro method, that we actually were getting easily desorbed plus some of the iron that was absorbed. And that's what happens in your stomach. You're basically desorbing the arsenic from the soil, and then you're dissolving a little bit of the iron because the pH is 1.8 or 2, you know, in that area. But I haven't seen a soil method or its extraction method that's been better correlated with an animal model yet than in vitro methods.
Okay, we can go back to the phone lines.
At that point, yeah.
We can go back to the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, press star 1, and state your name and organization. Okay, we'll take another one from the online participants. This is from Jimmy Sparrow from DTSC, California EPA again. He says, have you examined any of the newer bacterial reporter gene-based bioavailability assays for bioavailability of arsenic? Would using them in combination with the artificial stomach in vitro methods provide additional models for assessing bioavailability in soils?
I'm not sure if we're talking about bacterial models in the stomach or bacterial models in the colon. If it's in the stomach, no, we haven't looked at that. And we don't expect a lot of bacterial activity in the stomach. But in the colon, yes, we actually did do some work recently in collaboration with Dr. Tom Van De Wiel, who was here for a few weeks. And Tom was in the earlier slide the developer of the SHINE method, and he looks at bioaccessibility in the colon, the ascending colon, the large colon. And Tom's work shows that you could actually triple, the colon could actually triple the bioaccessible arsenic. And so, and actually Steve Cicilano and Brian Laird up in Saskatchewan have shown the same thing, where if you get into reduced conditions, strongly reduced conditions in the colon, you could have a significant increase in the release of arsenic in the bioaccessibility test. We're just trying to fix it. I guess what I'm curious about is people are trying to get their head around what that means, since most of the absorption occurs in the small intestine, not in the colon. So if you triple the bioaccessibility in the colon, it's almost like it is a trees falls in the wood type of thing. You're not sure what that impact might be, but it is, in a colon, it's critical that, you know, you incorporate a bacterial model. I'm not sure, I don't think it's the same model that the questioner from CalEPA was asking me, though. And no, I haven't looked at that specific one, but if that's what you're interested in the colon conditions, it's critical.
Thank you. We can try the phone lines one more time. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and press star 1, state your name and organization. Okay. If there are no more questions at this time, you can contact Dr. DeToro or Dr. Bassa via email with additional questions. Their email addresses are on the Superfund Basic Research Program at Risky Learning webpage that is on the Additional Resources page. I would like to thank our moderators, Dr. Claudia Thompson, the Acting Director of the Superfund Basic Research Program, Dr. Aaron Yao, Environmental Health Scientist, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, US EPA, and our presenters, Dr. Dominic DeToro, the Edward C. Davis Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, University of Delaware, and Dr. Nicholas Bassa, Professor of Soil and Environmental Chemistry, Ohio State University. This concludes today's seminar. Thank you for your participation.